Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. When Jack Welch took the helm of GE in 1981, the company was an American industrial giant. And by the time he retired a couple of decades later, GE was a global super conglomerate, one of the most respected companies in the world, super profitable with super happy shareholders. Here's how Welch himself described that transformation.
Over a span of a decade, we downsized our operations that we do. Now, we kept the high value-added manufacturing, the sophisticated tooling, the sophisticated machining, etc. But we got rid of some of the more mundane work that was taking place in the corporation.
Well, Jack Welch was described as the manager of the century. His approach birthed careers of other powerful CEOs who took the Welch style with them to other American companies. At the core of that approach, a relentless focus on value. Quarterly reports that always beat market expectations, even by a little bit, but that beating those expectations as the ultimate marker of success. So is there a downside to all that? Well, Jack Welch died on Sunday at the age of 84, so this hour On Point, how he transformed American corporate culture for better and for worse. So since we are going to be talking about the legacy of Jack Welch on American business, what better place to start than in the halls of a business school to hear how Welch's impact continues to reverberate amongst future business leaders? So joining us in the studio is Joseph Bauer. He's a professor emeritus at Harvard Business School. He's written case studies about Jack Welch and taught courses on management as well. Professor Bauer, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna.
So when you talked to students about Jack Welch and his impact on American business, how do you describe him to them?
Well, we have been following GE since well before Jack, and which turns out to be an important part of the story because what he was able to do had a lot to do with what his predecessors had done. What we say is that he really took very seriously the challenge of taking an American icon and helping it survive. People forget that the decade of the 80s was the decade in which American companies were falling by the wayside under attack from Japanese and German competitors. And he turned GE into a formidable competitor. And it was really quite remarkable. I was just thinking when he came to the school often, and in 1985 he addressed the second year class, and one of the students during questions asked him, "Well, what did you do wrong?" And he said, "Well, I didn't move fast enough. I tried too hard to be nice, to take my time, to work with people, and the environment just won't let you do that." He was famous for saying, "You got to face reality."
Wait, so he said he didn't move fast enough, and he'd been too nice. This from the man who was dubbed Neutron Jack for letting 100,000 people at GE go.
Exactly.
He thought he was being too nice?
Yes. Well, if you looked at what he inherited a wedding cake organization, layer upon layer upon layer. In the old days, the notion was there was a span of control, which was limited. And if you had more people than that, then you had a layer of organization that was simply, they were called span breakers. And GE had layer after layer. And then Reg Jones had introduced a very sophisticated strategic planning system that was an overlay on top of that. And he didn't fire workers. He fired layer after layer of middle managers. I had some MBAs in class who had worked at GE, And they all they could say was they died and gone to heaven because finally they could work with the business and work with their leaders. And they didn't have layers to go through.
Now, you mentioned Reg Jones, who was the previous CEO prior to Jack Welch.
Right.
What was so was that the biggest difference between the two, that Welch was looking and successfully made GE a faster and leaner company to transform with the times? And
well, Reg Jones, if you remember the 70s, that was the period where business and government were at loggerheads and we had a terrible inflation. And, I mean, Reg Jones had GE buy Utah Mining, one of the largest mining companies in the world. One of the first things Jack Welch did was sell it. He was dealing with a totally different set of circumstances. Mm-hmm. And Jack was in this 80s were a very, very difficult period in the United States. Yeah. And he made GE lean and mean.
So in your, you know, in your writing the cases about Jack Welch and his management style in your discussions with him, and when he came to speak to your students at Harvard Business School, how did Welch himself define success?
He said he wanted GE to be the fastest growing, most profitable company in the United States, in the world, really.
Fastest growing and
I have
profitable.
A quote if you want me
yeah,
to get.
Yeah, please do.
Well, okay. Yeah. Let's ask another and I'll.
Well, actually, while you look for that quote, let me play something from, let's hear Jack Welch himself, roughly in the mid-90s, talking about why he really sold off quite a few of GE's business divisions after he took over the company. A lot of it had to do with his own experience coming up the ranks from GE. Because remember, we should actually mention he started as a chemical engineer. PhD chemical engineer at General Electric in Western Massachusetts. But here's what Welch himself said.
I would say my experience with being in running some businesses in GE that were number one and some businesses that were number four and five. So I had the luxury of a laboratory in GE. I ran the electronic components business, the motor business, the medical business, the plastics business, all at once. So I saw this group of businesses, some which were leaders and some which were big followers. And it was clear to me that one was a hell of a lot easier and a hell of a lot better than the other one. And the other one didn't have the resources and the muscle and the power to compete on a global scale that was emerging in the decade of the 80s.
So Professor Bauer, that's one way that Welch described it. How did you want to describe his version of success?
I remember that because I think I interviewed him. You have some of my tapes. He said, I want GE to be the most profitable, highly diversified company on earth with world quality leadership in every one of its product lines. So he would also say, relevant to what he admired Andy Grove because he thought semiconductors was such a terrible business. In that interview, he said, I don't know how the guy does it. But he would say, we have to get rid of businesses where I can go down the street to Walmart and buy it cheaper than it comes out of my factory.
Okay.
That was the world he was dealing with.
So it makes a lot of sense to seek being profitable through excellence in products.
Yes.
Totally makes a lot of sense. Then how do you explain GE Capital? I mean, that's a huge part of this story, isn't it?
What was GE Capital making
other than financial tools Welch was using?
Initially, GE Capital was basically leasing and lending, and it was a wonderful competitive advantage to GE.
Right, because essentially they would help people borrow money to buy GE products.
Exactly. Right. So if I was buying GE engines, I could lease them through GE. I could lease locomotives. I could lease all this big, heavy stuff, and it was a tremendous advantage. Later, as part of the strategic work they did, they began to understand that a business like aircraft or aircraft engines or MRI medical equipment needed maintenance and service. And if they thought of their business as delivering air travel or delivering medical, Then they began to do the service as well. And again, that meant they had to carry that equipment. And so GE Capital became a tremendous advantage, but it also became a wonderful business, and they began to expand. And you're quite right. By the time Jack Welch leaves GE, they have about $500 billion in debt.
Let's say that again, $500 billion in debt. Okay.
Exactly. And poor Jeff Immelt takes over and 9/11 happens and the insurance business crashes, the market crashes. He's got this albatross on his hand.
Right.
But absolutely right. My own view is Jack probably stayed seven years too long.
Right. So we've got about a minute and a half that we have left with you, Professor Bauer. I'm just curious, today, if you were teaching a class on management and using Welch as an example, would you recommend to students that Jack Welch is a CEO, a leader that they ought to try and emulate?
Only in the sense that he recognized the circumstances that he was dealing with, that he was in GE was going to be toast if they didn't change. Later on, today's students would not work in the kind of organization that Jack ran. They have a different set of values. They have different aspirations. The business world is totally different. The competitors are – we have really powerful competitors coming from China, Japan, as well as Germany and Europe. It's just a different business world. If Jack were starting now, I'm sure he would do something different. But he stayed for a long time. 20 years is – my own view is you need to reinvent your company about every decade, and he didn't.
Okay. Well, Joseph Bauer is professor emeritus at Harvard Business School, a corporate strategy expert as well. He's written case studies about Jack Welch and his tenure at GE. Professor Bauer, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk with Jack Welch's biographer and a business expert, a business journalist who has a very different view of the legacy that Welch had on American corporate culture. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the upside and the downside of legendary GE CEO Jack Welch's legacy on American corporate culture. Welch died on Sunday at the age of 84. He had been dubbed the manager of the century. So let's dig deep and understand better what his broad impact on how America does business actually is. So joining us now from San Francisco is John Byrne. He's chairman and editor-in-chief of Sea Change Media Incorporated, former executive editor and editor-in-chief of BusinessWeek.com. He co-authored Jack Welch's best-selling memoir, Jack, Straight from the Gut. John Byrne, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Also with us from New York is Joe Nocera. He's Bloomberg opinion columnist covering business, former editorial director of Fortune magazine. Joe Nocera, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Joe, actually in the break there, the professor, before he left, Professor Bauer, he said, you know what? in the dozens of hours of interviews that he had with Jack Welch and the many years that he knew him, Welch never once mentioned the word share price or shareholder value to him.
Give me a break.
So what? Why?
That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Sorry, Professor. Listen, when before Jack Welch became a CEO, GE used to think of itself as a proxy for the economy, and its mission, its goal, was just to do better than the economy. When Jack took over, he changed the mission to say the world's most valuable company. Well, how do you become the world's most valuable company? You get the stock price up. That's how you do it. And he may not have used the phrase maximizing shareholder value, but he exemplified it, and he taught the rest of corporate America executives to also strive for the same goal, which in addition to making the shareholders rich, made the CEOs very rich because their compensation became completely tied to the price of the stock.
Okay, so I'm gonna ask you in a second, Joe, what's the problem with that? But let me get John in here to give us his two cents. Do you dispute that characterization of Welch, John?
Well, it's true that shareholder value is not even mentioned in his book. Neither is the primacy of the investor. He talks about customers a lot. He talks about his own employees a lot. He talks about his suppliers and the need to have great relationships with them. He doesn't say all I was doing was jacking up the stock price. So, look, you can't blame Jack for the total rise of the shareholder value movement merely because GE performed so well and its stock went up so high. Yeah, there's probably a connection there. Yes, he did look at market cap as a scoreboard of sorts. And if you look at comparative performance, GE versus other companies, you look back at 1980. This is really interesting, right? And you look at the Fortune 500. You have General Motors number two, Ford is number four, IBM is number eight, GE is number nine, AT&T, people won't even remember them, but there was another conglomerate, number 11, U.S. Steel 14, DuPont 16, Chrysler 17, Tenneco 18, AT&T 19. Mm-hmm. You move forward 20 years, and GE is number two, and every one of those other companies is not in the top 20 at all. Many of them aren't on the list of 500. Now, why? Because they weren't doing what Jack was doing, because they weren't playing a game of winning, because they weren't investing in their people, because they weren't doing the kinds of things that Jack did that in many cases took tremendous courage. Laying people off when a company was profitable was unheard of. Jack did it, and it was important to do.
So, Joe, I'm going to come back to you in a second, but why, John, why lay people off when a company is profitable? What did that allow Welch to achieve?
Well, he was running a lot of operations that were unprofitable. The whole of the company was profitable, but the operations that a lot of these people were involved in was not, or was suboptimal. And he needed to shed them and focus on what was working and then reinvest in the things that were working and the things that will work in the future. And you couldn't do that in a company that had that many employees. Yeah. GM, Ford, and Chrysler couldn't easily do that because they were unionized. And the result of their inability to respond to the market was their tremendous decline.
Mm. So, Joe, I mean, what John is describing now seems to be kind of almost an unquestioned mantra in American business, right? That in order to be lean and responsive and nimble and being able to stay competitive in a global marketplace, this is exactly the kind of thing that you need to do. So what's the problem?
Well, let's start with laying off people. I understand that there are times when that has to be done, and I would agree that the auto industry, the auto companies, you know, had a lot of issues around that. But I would also argue that, you know, prior to Jack, and I can't lay this all on him, but certainly there was a bond, a company and an employee had a loyalty towards each other that actually meant something. And the employee felt that they were safe in a company and that the company would take care of them if they did their job. And of course, that doesn't exist anymore. Jack had a mantra. This was interesting. I wrote a very tough-minded column about Jack a few days ago. And one of the things I did not mention was his belief that you should, you know, reward highly the top performers in your group and you should fire the bottom 10% mm-hmm. every year.
Mm-hmm.
I got so many emails from people saying people on Wall Street even saying you forgot about this. And I can't tell you how much harm it did to my company because everybody wanted to follow Jack because that's what Jack said. And Jack was the god of management.
Yeah. I mean, we've even got like a comment that's come in online from one of our listeners who says exactly that. Welch introduced an annual employee review system at General Electric that incorporated ranking all of its employees and firing the lower 10%. Within GE, it was referred to as rank and yank. This was recognized as self-destructive and abandoned after Welch retired.
Right. And I got one from somebody who said, I had a group of 10 people. And I knew, and they knew, that at the end of every year, I would have to fire one of them. You know, how does that help cohesion and compatibility and getting the job done? I mean, it doesn't. Look, was Jack a good manager? Yes, Jack was a good manager. But Jack set in place a number of ideas because he was so important and because his philosophy was followed so religiously that have harmed American business. And I would say shareholder value is one of them. And I would say this rank and yank is another one.
John, do you want to...
And I would say the emphasis on finance at GE Capital was a third.
I do want to talk about GE Capital in detail in a second. But John Byrne, go ahead and respond.
Well, this is one of the more controversial ideas that Jack had, and he called it the vitality curve or differentiation. And yes, indeed, GE did rank its employees from top to bottom. And GE spent an inordinate amount of time on managing people and figuring out who was the best, who can contribute the most. This idea that GE fired the bottom 10% of its employee base every year is fiction. It is true that Jack argued that the bottom 10% should be fired. They never were. Jack understood that in management and in leadership, you often have to take extreme positions to get movement. And so if you say, I want quality, you don't get quality. You have to scream it from the rooftops. You have to yell and scream as much as you can over many years and then institute systems to make quality a reality. In truth, there was no 10% of the lowest employees being fired. There were probably about 3 or 4%, I'll give you that, and they probably deserve to be fired because here's what human nature is. Most people have a really difficult time telling others that their performance stinks. And we know in every organization that we are in, there are non-performers who often get away with non-performing because management doesn't have the guts or the stamina or the courage to go and do what's necessary to get people out who are not doing the job. And that's an important part of being a manager is knowing how to fire people. There was never, again, 10% of the lowest employees that were fired from GE in any year, not even 5%.
Okay. Well, I want to play an interview that Welch gave to 60 Minutes on CBS in October of 2000. This was just before, a little bit before he stepped down as GE CEO. And he talked about this, about raising the bar for his business, even if that meant having to let go of some employees in the process.
In the end, if they don't improve, they can't.
They're out of here.
The best thing you can do to an employee is early on, as early as you know they're the bottom 10, let them know, so they can go on and adjust their life and get in the right game, in the right level of company. That's, in my view, a kinder, gentler company than the company that winks at the truth.
So, Joe Nocera, here's what I wonder about this sort of bottom 10% rank and yank issue. You heard the Professor Bauer, before the break, talk about the time period in which Jack Welch came to become the head of GE. So 1981, the challenging decade of the 80s, coming out of the moribund 70s here. I mean, we have to judge people in the context of their time. So it wasn't this actually a necessary thing for Welch to incorporate into GE, into American corporate culture, to make it more responsive to a rapidly globalizing world?
To some extent, I think. I think that American business did need to become leaner and meaner. I mean, that is true. And a lot of the success of Carl Icahn and Boone Pickens and the other Raiders at that time was around the idea that companies had become sluggish. And you could look at certain industries and you could say that was certainly true. And you could also say that Jack, you know, really brought General Electric to attention, to that everybody started moving forward in the same direction, and there was a lot less. It became a much less sluggish organization for absolutely sure. I guess my issue with this has less to do with what happened inside GE than with the way it became a mantra for so many other companies, where it may not have been appropriate and where it may have been done in a destructive way. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at the landscape now, there are very few companies that do this sort of thing. Now, one that does actually is Netflix. But they do it they hire really smart people and they tell them very early on, they give them, coaching and advice. And if they don't work out, they let them go very quickly and they give them a lot of money.
Yeah.
They give them a bunch of money. And, you know, it's a small company. They can get away with it. But larger companies have largely abandoned this practice because it was destructive internally.
Okay. So, Joe, let me just switch gears here a little bit, and because I'd like you to make the case for the central claim in your critical view of Welch here. Because you pointed out in your piece this week that in the 80s, first of all, there was a lot going on. Speaking of Welch being a man of his time, it's the Reagan era. It's the primacy of free market economics. It's an era of business-friendly policies, deregulation, et cetera. That's all in the stew here. And then there's also this, like, seemingly at the time, unending bull market, right? And so, like, everyone kind of tended to do better over time. It's just that GE did a little better than most. How did Welch do that?
Well, look, some of it is absolutely positively good management, buying the right companies, selling the right companies, putting the right people in charge of various divisions. No question about it. But you also can't deny that he had the wind at his back and that we had he took over the company in 1981. The bull market starts in August of 1982. The bull market ends in March of 2000. He leaves in September of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, both periods when it was not a bull market, GE stock went down. So, yes, he did better than the S&P 500, no question about it. But he also had the wind at his back. And he also did things that made Wall Street really, really happy, most prominently. He always seemed to beat earnings by a penny or two pennies. And when you think of the size of GE, and it's this big, sprawling conglomerate. I mean, the idea that you can do that quarter after quarter after quarter after quarter is kind of unbelievable.
Well, John Byrne, Joe in his piece says you can't do that at a conglomerate the size of GE unless you are playing accounting games. What do you think, John?
Well, I want to address the earlier point. Look, GM, Ford, IBM, U.S. Steel, Chrysler, Westinghouse, DuPont, AT&T, they all had the wind on their back as well. And that wind pushed them down and in some cases pushed them out of business. So to say that GE did a little bit better than other major American companies is totally false. GE did a lot better. It set standards around the world for competing. In terms of the record of quarterly earnings, you know, that I think that that was a reflection of brilliant management. Here's what Jack knew. Jack knew that GE was a highly complicated company. It was in a lot of different business lines. It was not an easy company to understand. It's a company that defied even the organization of Wall Street analysis, where analysts focus on a given sector. Well, GE was in every sector. So the most important thing that GE could do is be consistent and be predictable to Wall Street and to the investors. And so, yes, he would have meetings every quarter, and when they were short, he'd go around the room to all his leaders and say, "Who's going to help me this quarter?" That's managing. He did nothing that was illegal, nothing that was wrong. He played the game according to the rules, and he played it brilliantly.
Well, so who's going to help me this quarter, though, is a different management message than who's going to build this business for the next 5 or 10 years.
Well, that was just one meeting.
Okay. Well, we'll talk more about Jack Welch's legacy on American corporate culture when we come back. John Byrne and Joe Nocera join us. We'll dig into this, what GE Capital was, and also the people, the managers and CEOs that came up underneath Jack Welch and the ideas they took with them to other sectors of American industry. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the upside and the downside of Jack Welch's legacy on American corporate culture. Welch was, of course, the legendary CEO of GE. He served in that position for 20 years, from 1981. He died on Sunday at the age of 84. I'm joined today by John Byrne. He is chairman and editor-in-chief of Sea Change Media Incorporated, and he co-authored Welch's best-selling memoir, Jack, Straight from the Gut. John joins us from San Francisco today. Joe Nocera is also with us. He's Bloomberg opinion columnist covering business and former editorial director of Fortune magazine. Now, gentlemen, I've been saying this a couple times, so let's just do it. I want to dig into the story of GE Capital a little bit because I think it's quite illustrative, right? We talked earlier in the hour with the professor about the original intent of GE Capital and how that rapidly changed under Jack Welch. And by the time Welch retired, GE Capital was this enormous financial operation, $500 billion, we heard, that was entangled in things like credit cards, insurance, subprime mortgages, things like shadow banking. And in the 2008 financial crisis, GE Capital suffered enormously. It needed, reading here, a $12 billion injection from private investors, $140 billion almost in a federal bailout. And yet it seems as if to me, and Joe, I'll start with you, that GE Capital was a source of the sort of financial fuel that kept GE looking really great to shareholders for many years under Welch's tenure.
I think that's right. I think there are two issues here. One is you know, how it operated inside General Electric, and it was an enormous engine of profit at the same time that subprime mortgages, for instance, were generating enormous profits all over Wall Street because they were rated AAA, and we all know how that all turned out. And also, I mean, I don't know if John agrees with this or not, but my analysis was always that GE Capital was the black box that allowed Jack to generate those earnings quarter after quarter after quarter. The larger point, I think, has to do with the financialization of American business, so that finance arms became more important and more powerful, almost in many cases, than what the company was supposed to be doing in the first place, the manufacturing or it would transform itself into more of a financialized company because that's where the profits were.
John, what do you think?
GE Capital under Welch was a brilliant reinvention of what it had been. Mm-hmm. Well, it essentially melded two things together, money and brains. And here was the genius of it. GE sold a lot of equipment that cost a lot of money, like a power generation plant, like a railroad engine, like an aircraft engine, like medical equipment, the most sophisticated in the world. And the people who bought that equipment, frankly, needed to finance it. And what Jack was able to do by making GE Capital so important, so aggressive, is he could take the prices down on the hardware to virtually break even and compete with all of his rivals at a totally different level. Because if you bring the hardware cost down, but you're going to either lease or finance the equipment and then service it, you can get the profit on the financing or the servicing. So in other words, GE Capital allowed him to play a strategic competitive game that wasn't available to most of his competitors. You know, the leverage lease on an aircraft could earn 30% or better returns. Many of his competitors didn't have a finance arm at the time.
Right. And can
so
I just jump
changed
in?
The game.
And it makes a lot of sense. I mean, like, for example, the automakers were doing something similar to help people buy their cars. So it's sort of like a direct connection between various sectors of a major company. But then on that link seems to be broken when GE Capital starts entering markets like insurance and subprime mortgages. I mean, what did that have to do with GE's core businesses? I mean, that's the financialization part that Joe's pointing to, isn't it?
Of course. Now, GE Capital was not overexposed in subprime mortgages. In fact, Jeff Immelt, Jack's successor, bought one of the largest subprime mortgage companies in America within a year of the total collapse. GE was not overexposed in a way that made the entire company vulnerable. The truth is, in GE, there was an unwritten rule. And the rule basically was GE Capital can never be more than a certain percentage of our assets, our revenue, or our profit. Because if it exceeds that threshold, Wall Street will look at us differently and value us differently. Our PE would change dramatically. When Jeff Immelt came in, he violated that rule. He expanded the company's exposure to the financial markets, even buying the subprime mortgage company, among many other things that were done. And it made GE more susceptible to being challenged when the markets collapsed.
Mm. Joe, you want to respond to that?
Well, I want to ask John something. I mean, you're absolutely right about what Jeff did. I mean, I think he felt under pressure to keep earnings up, and this was the only way he could do it. But do you think, John, that if Jack was still running GE in the 2005, 6, 7, 8 period, he would have avoided the problems that took place at GE Capital after the financial crisis?
Here's what I know. And this goes back to the point that was made earlier about the difference between Reg Jones and Jack Welch. And it is, in fact, on some level, a difference between Jack Welch and Jeff Immelt. Reg Jones was a statesman. He was a diplomat. He was the person who was held in high esteem, who went to Washington a lot to basically try to influence Washington and limit government regulation of business. He was not a roll-up-your-sleeves, get-involved kind of guy who got his hands dirty every day in the business. That's what Jack was. There was not an acquisition that GE Capital made that didn't have Jack's approval. None. Zero. He approved every single acquisition GE Capital made. That's how involved he was. Jeff Immelt became more of a Reg Jones at a time when the company could not afford it. He became more of a statesman. He went to State of the Union addresses. He was an advisor on economics to Obama. He didn't roll up his sleeves the way Jack did, and I think that made a very big difference. So if Jack were still involved through this crisis period, sure, GE would have been knocked down like every other company. But GE never would have suffered the fate that it did under Jeff Immelt.
Joe, do you buy that?
I don't know. I truly don't know. Jim Collins, the great management consultant, once told Business Week, actually, that the jury would be out on Jack until we saw how his successor performed because, naming his successor was one of the single most important things a CEO can do. And, you know, by the end of Jeff's tenure, GE was in near collapse. So, you know, obviously you put that on Jeff, but does Jack deserve some of the blame for that? I think he does, but it's just hard to know whether Jack would have been foresighted enough to avoid the problems that Jeff could not avoid at the financial crisis.
So, gentlemen, if I could, the real big picture question we have here is, what is Jack Welch's long-term legacy in American business? And I think there are actually some direct ways to measure that. And to do so, I'm just going to focus our attention for a moment on the current crisis at Boeing regarding the 737 MAX aircraft. And why? Because a lot of people trace Boeing's current problems in terms of its current corporate culture back to the merger that Boeing underwent with McDonnell Douglas in the 1990s. So in January of this year, I spoke with Leon Grunberg. He's a professor at the University of Puget Sound in Washington State. He's researched culture at Boeing extensively. And as I mentioned, we talked with the professor about the Boeing McDonnell Douglas merger. And why? Because on the McDonnell Douglas side of things, there were several key alums of GE, such as Harry Stonecipher and James McNerney, who came up under Jack Welch at GE. So they brought a lot of Welch corporate philosophy with them to McDonnell Douglas and then later to Boeing, which changed Boeing. So here's a clip from my conversation with Professor Grunberg.
The GE culture that actually spawned people like Stonecipher, and another CEO, McNerney, and so on, really was to try and sort of squeeze the costs out of production and to try and maximize shareholder value. And they could always find ways to cut costs and to drive efficiency to try and increase profits.
Interesting. Now, just to take a step back here for a second, you said the GE culture. I mean, is that sort of the Jack Welch view of trying to the financialization of manufacturing?
It's amazing the power he had. I think the current CEO who's just taken over yesterday is also a GE product. So he spread his wings far.
So that's Professor Leon Grunberg from the University of Puget Sound. Now, Joe Nocera, in that same show, we had an engineer on who had worked at Boeing for decades, and she said one of the first things that the company felt when they merged with McDonnell Douglas was this change, this managerial mindset that changed from being an engineering-centered company at Boeing to being one that was really concerned with profit maximization. Is it too much to say that that is the reverberation of the Jack Welch legacy?
In my view, Boeing is the perfect example of Jack Welch's legacy. Stonecipher, he actually moved the company to Chicago. Just the executives, not the engineers. There was so much more focus on share price. There was so much more focus on cost cutting. So then you get McNerney, who knows nothing about airplanes. But hey, if you're a GE manager, you can manage anything, right? So he gets the job at Boeing, and they make decisions around the MAX that are disastrous, and they do it because, they don't want to have to start from scratch to build a new airplane. They want to take an airplane that they already have, they want to retrofit it, they want to put on engines that are too heavy, and they want to cut corners like crazy. And why do they do that? In part because they want to be able to keep the stock price up, and they don't want to have the timeout that will help Airbus and hurt them and also delay coming out with this new airplane. And, we know what the result is. I do not blame Jack Welch right. for the two airplane crashes, but I do say that culture that permeated Boeing and has permeated so many companies really comes from Jack.
So, John, respond to that last point, the sort of long-term cultural impact that Welch had on American business. Joe doesn't see it as an entirely positive thing, obviously.
Sure, and that's understandable. I mean, I think, Jack was a highly controversial figure on so many dimensions, to be honest. However, if you were to say who is the single biggest proponent of quality – in the years that Jack was in charge of GE, in the corporate world, other than
John,
the importance of quality, like a Deming, it would be Jack Welch. Jack Welch made Six Sigma quality metrics a religion within GE. Now, part of Six Sigma was driving out needless costs, not costs that would harm people or result in less safe product or services, okay? But he was focused totally on quality, not necessarily on squeezing every nickel and dime out of the business that would endanger people. That's just a cheap shot, really. And incidentally, McNerney, he left in 2015. Now, I don't know the entire history of the development of the MAX airplane, so I can't speak to that. But he was gone for more than 5 years already when that happened.
So, Joe Nocera, it seems to me, I want to know where we go from here because, yes, I mean, Jack Welch was not uniquely responsible for the total, the primacy of the financialization of American business. He was a very influential person in that, though. But looking forward now, do you see any shift in that mindset? Do you see corporate leaders sort of stepping back from that a little bit? I mean, have the corrections of 2001 and 2008 been wake-up calls? What do you think?
Well, no, they haven't been wake-up calls. But more recently, they're talking a better game. The Business Roundtable, rewrote their mission statement to downplay shareholder value a little bit. Larry Fink at BlackRock is always writes his annual letter about how business must be more socially conscious and do more to help the world beyond maximizing shareholder value. The problem is the great if you're a CEO or a board member, the great thing about shareholder value is it's easy to measure. Mm-hmm. It's easy to measure a CEO because you say the stock price went up 15% or the stock price went down 15%. If you're not, it's hard to figure out a different measure that works.
Well, Joe Nocera is Bloomberg opinion columnist covering business and former editorial director of Fortune magazine. We have a link to his column about Jack Welch at onpointradio.org. Joe, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. And John, thanks for talking to me again. It's been a long time.
I know. It was great to hear your voice.
John Byrne, Chairman and Editor-in-Chief of Sea Change Media Incorporated, co-author of Jack Welch's best-selling memoir, Jack, Straight from the Gut. John, thank you. Thank you so much for being with us.
My total pleasure.
And folks, tomorrow is our Friday News Roundtable. We want to know if you have a question about the U.S. response to coronavirus, to the results from Super Tuesday, or on abortion cases at the Supreme Court. Call our voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.